Did we flesh out the riot in 68 in Chicago? Was there more to the story? Did I move on too fast to something else? Did you have any more personal experience?
No, you just asked what happened in the 60s that I recall while I was at KOTV, and that was one of the things. We were doing all of the regular local stuff that we should have done in the 60s. I guess the only thing that I can point to with some degree of pride in the 60s that I was responsible for, at least, we were the first station in Tulsa to cover the legislature. You can say what you want about the legislature, but it was just as bad then as it is now. But it was also just as important. I hired the first black television anchor. I hired the first female television anchor.
Can you put names to those? The first black television anchor.
That would have been Dale Hogg. Those kinds of things happened during that particular time. There would come a time at KOTV, but this is going down the road a little bit, starting in 71, when there were a lot of changes at that point. And when we had new management in 76, all of that stopped. So that's why I know those dates so well.
But in 1969, you go to Los Angeles.
Yeah, ABC called, just out of the blue. I think what happened was that we were more than reasonably successful at KOTV. And when you have something like that happen in the market, in broadcasting, radio or TV, sometimes your competitors will tell people like agents that there's a situation going on in Tulsa. Channel 8, for example, may want to get somebody from Channel 6 out of the market. So the agent goes around and looks for stations who are looking for people. And I think that's what happened in this case, because KABC, which is the ABC-owned and operated station in Los Angeles, certainly weren't making a search or anything. They were looking for a third anchor, not a Monday through Friday person, but somebody who could do weekends solo and be a reporter 3 days a week. That's the job that they had, and they called just totally out of the blue. I went out there, and there weren't any contract negotiations. It was, you know, do you want to do this? Here's the money. And I said, sure, if I can get out of my contract. And they let me out, and so went out there.
Significant in your time there, which was from 1969 to 1971, You met your present wife, Nancy.
Right.
Tell us how that came about.
Our seats were assigned together at the Charles Manson murder trial, the Tate-LaBianca murder trial, as it was called. I was working, of course, at KABC, and Nancy had graduated a couple of years earlier from college, and she was working at an independent television station. I can't remember the call letters, but at any rate, there was such a demand for seats at the Manson trial on the part of the press that they had to actually reserve part of the public seating behind the bar for the press, and each station had its assigned seat. Our seats were together, and she was really good looking. Still is.
What were her reporting skills?
She was a writer, actually, but I think she was of the age and of the temperament that she really wanted to see why Charles Manson could attract young, otherwise intelligent women. I'm not sure she'd put it in exactly that kind of phrase, but that's what she was there for. There was a great mystery about Manson. You know, how did he do what he did? What kind of hold did he have over these people who would join him and live this wretched lifestyle and kill for him? How nutty are we becoming after that tumult and all of this change of the 60s? And here it is. This is right at the end of the 60s, because that's when the Tate-LaBianca killings were. And the emergence of this communal thing that had started in the 60s and then somehow took this dramatically wrong turn with people like Manson. So there was a great deal of interest that way.
Right. And can you just, in a nutshell, for our historic sake, explain what happened, as there were initially five people that were killed, and why this came to the attention of the nation?
Well, Charlie's band at the time included, his family, as it was called, included 15 or 20. The number kind of moved in and out. My own view is that their brains were all fried by LSD. It's the first time I'd ever seen anybody who had been under the influence of LSD for a long time. But they were really spooky. And they were living out on some deserted ranch out north of Los Angeles. So Charlie tells four of them, one man and three women, all of them under 25, some of them from very good families, no college graduates, I don't think, but some who had been to college, to go to this house in Topanga Canyon in Los Angeles, it's in the Hollywood Hills, and kill them all. So they did. One of them happened to be Sharon Tate, who was at that time Roman Polanski's wife. She was 8 months pregnant, and the killings were sadistic. They were with knives and ropes and all kinds of bad things. Just terrible. And then the next night, he takes another group out, still some of the first ones, to another house. It's not so specific about this one. I've forgotten the neighborhood now. Just go into their house and kill them. And they did, and it turned out to be LaBiancas, who were middle-aged, white, reasonably wealthy, upper middle class, certainly.
Grocery store chain owner, I believe.
Right. They stuck a carving fork into Mrs. LaBianca, I think, left it there. Carved letters on their dead bodies, and left messages in blood. I mean, the whole thing was just a nightmare. When I arrived in Los Angeles, that had already happened, but we were still doing things like trying to run down threads of it. And it was KABC, not me, not my crew, but the people who found the gun that was used in both of those. And they did it by retracing what they figured out were the steps of the killers after they did their killing and what roads they would likely have driven on and where it would be good spots to throw out a gun. By God, about the second place they looked, they found the gun. It's crazy, things like that.
Charlie Manson, was he in the courtroom then?
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
so
all the time.
He was just as nuts
as everybody thinks he is, yeah. Big long beard, stuff carved into his forehead, swastikas and things like that. And then the girls would have it the next day. They kept him separate, of course, outside the courtroom. But when the girls saw him and that he had this thing in his face, then they would all cut their heads the same way. But they just had this look in their eye as if they were astonished at where they were, and they wanted to look around and see as if they were in, I don't know, it's kind of like looking at a zoo. Here are these people up there who you have no contact with whatsoever. Although I did come to actually know one of the members of the family. One of them who was not charged was Squeaky Frome. She just got out of prison, as a matter of fact, because she tried to kill President Ford years later up in Sacramento, I think. But Squeaky would act as the family spokesperson, and she would sit on the lawn outside the courthouse and answer any questions that you had. So if you were in TV, then you like to have sound and you like to have pictures, but you can't take pictures in the courtroom, couldn't of that. You had some stock footage occasionally that you would get of Manson and the girls walking down the hall, but the only sound you're ever going to get is Squeaky's. So Squeaky was on a lot. I mean, she was interviewed many more minutes than she ever got on the air, because it's so hard to get anything that sounded any place close to sanity out of her. But at least you could get a comment, you know, how's the family taking this, that kind of thing. You never knew what she was likely to say, but sometimes it would be airworthy.